Welcome to the podcast, Chatting with Brad and Doug. This is Doug.
And this is Brad.
Today's episode, we will be returning to a book slash story slash film that we've covered before. Only this time, we will not be beanstalking.
Sad.
Unfortunately. Beanstalking somewhere in the future for sure, but today's podcast is on Saruman.
Saruman the White. Saruman of many colors. He is a wizard in Lord of the Rings. And they are kind of a group of demigods, I guess would be a way of putting it, who were sent to Middle-earth to combat Sauron on behalf of the Olympian set of gods who live in the Nine Lands.
Yeah, they're not exactly old men, as appearances would have you believe. They're far more powerful than that. And in the case of Saruman, we were discussing he wasn't born a villain. He wasn't born that way. He sort of became one over time. As you said, he was, among the other wizards, put on Middle-earth to sort of fight evil, as it were. And in doing such, yeah, he becomes evil. And yeah, just kind of interesting to note that this is, I mean, we've done sort of complicated characters before, like with Shades of Grey, but this is like our first, I would say, outright villain, like our purely evil antagonist character. So,
right, and as we know, Christopher Lee just cannot play a good guy; he has to play a bad guy,
and quite a bad guy he plays. Certainly much better than the villain he plays in Attack of the Clones, Count Dooku.
Yes. Although, I know we're not talking about Count Dooku, but there's a certain awesomeness to him that I kind of admire. But we'll get into that later. But Saruman is an interesting character in Lord of the Rings, because in the whole of the set of, I don't know what to call it, all of the books that take place in this universe that Lord of the Rings is set in, the Silmarillion, the Hobbit, Lord of the Rings, he's the only character who goes from being a good guy to being a bad guy in the same narrative. In the narrative that, with the exception of Morgoth slash Melkor, but you know, that happens so fast it almost doesn't count.
And you kind of see that it's pretty obvious that Morgoth is going to take that turn.
Well, yeah, they create 12 gods, and then they create a 13th who's more powerful than the rest. I wonder what he's going to do.
It's like what you said, never make a 13th anybody. It's like, stop at 12.
Especially the 13th warrior.
Yeah, exactly. They only have 12 muses. Like, nobody ever said, we need a 13th muse.
12 Olympian gods?
Yeah. What was Judas the 13th apostle?
Yes, he was.
I guess that's why they say the 12 apostles, so.
12 apostles plus Jesus.
Yeah.
And so Judas, yeah.
All right. Any other 12s that you can think of at this moment? Or 13s? I don't know.
12 were the 13th evil. There's a bunch of them out there. I think there's Babylonian there might be, but I'm pretty sure in Aztec and Mayan culture there are, too.
Yeah, fair enough.
Though I'm not as familiar with those mythologies as I am with Western mythology, or European mythology, I guess they are Western.
Yeah.
In that sense. Morgoth was pretty obviously going to be bad from the beginning. But Saruman is explicitly sent to Middle-earth as part of this group of five wizards who were going to save, we were going to keep Middle-earth safe from Sauron, because this is in the wake of, Morgoth has been defeated at this point for a long time, and Sauron's already been defeated once, but now the Numenoreans are kind of gone, the elves are leaving Middle-earth, and it's a transition period towards, I guess, modern man. In a lot of ways, you can see Lord of the Rings as a transition from a magical world to a world of men and non-mist mystical and mythical things.
Yeah, that's what the Lord of the Rings is about. The end of the Third Age, which is like the age of like magic and wonder, elves, and you know all those other kind of stuff. Yeah. And the when the ring is destroyed, and as is Sauron's armies, that you know the new age, the age of men, begins, and that starts with Aragorn's reign as king of you know Middle Earth and whatnot.
And by the time Lord of the Rings ends, the only magical thing left in Middle Earth is, I guess, the hobbits
and Tom Bombadil, of course.
Tom Bombadil.
Well, Tom Bombadil just kind of exists in his own kind of weird little, like... He's his
own... He doesn't fit in the structure.
We gotta... FYI, we gotta return to Tom Bombadil at some point. That's definitely worth inspecting.
Yes, it is. But, you know, like, if you look at it, all the the last of the elves leave Middle-earth at the end of Lord of the Rings. The wizards are gone or leave Middle-earth. I guess they never account for Radagast, the brown, but nobody cares about Radagast in the first place.
He's going to be in the Hobbit film.
He is.
He's actually being played by Sylvester McCoy, who was one of the doctors in Doctor Who, but...
oh, awesome.
Yeah, so...
okay, but I guess Radagast isn't accounted for. Saruman's dead. Gandalf leaves Middle-earth with the last of the elves. The Ents are kind of gone. The Eagles are never really there to begin with. They just kind of hang out on their own and only show up in dire circumstances. The Orcs are gone. Orcs, Goblins, Trolls, Balrogs, all gone. And so what you're left with is mortal men who live fairly normal-length lives, living in this medieval-esque transitioning into industrial society. And that's kind of where Lord of the Rings gets its transition. And so Saruman is kind of there to shepherd the transition, because either this transition happens or Sauron and the orcs are going to take over. And there's really no in-between. Those are kind of the two choices. There's no peaceful coexistence between orcs and men. And that's just kind of the way it is. And he reneges on that duty, which I think is very interesting.
Yeah, no, it is interesting, and that actually drives the conflict and the action for, the early parts of Lord of the Rings. I mean, as Sauron kind of fades away, the war still goes on, but, you know, he kind of gets the ball rolling in the sort of War of the Ring that we see in, you know, that begins in the Fellowship of the Ring and... the Two Towers. Return of the King, he's pretty much out of the picture at that point, but, you know, and the conflict still continues, but, you know, he really, like, initiates this what turns out to be the last stand of Sauron and the last stand of, like, the orcs, as you say.
Right. Yeah, and I just think it's an example of power corrupting, because Saruman is... kind of, because Sauron's power is kind of coalescing and returning. And it only does that because of the ring in the first place. But before Sauron's power starts to coalesce and become more powerful, Saruman is kind of de facto the most powerful being in Middle-earth. And so he's got that sort of power that he can hold over everybody. And that is where he derives his authority from the fact that he is, quote, the most powerful being in existence. Certainly of the good guys, he's the most powerful. You know, he's more powerful than Gandalf, he's more powerful than any of the elves or anything like that. And I think he starts to have delusions of grandeur, so to speak, and hubris, because he starts to think, as Sauron starts to come back, he starts like, hey, I can take on Sauron, I can make my own ring, and I can defeat Sauron even if he gets the ring. And he starts to move along those lines, and that line of thinking, which is, I think, just a pure example of a phenomenon that's talked about an awful lot.
The word hubris definitely comes to mind. That's your word, not mine. But It's kind of interesting to note, we had spoken about this, you know, earlier. You know, Tolkien kind of, you know, in the Silmarillion, in Lord of the Rings, The Hobbit, you know, he goes over, they're absolutely brilliant, you know, case studies in individuals who seek power, and, you know, there's this pattern that these individuals or characters exhibit, which is that, you know, in trying to master or control reality, other beings or individuals, what they're essentially doing is they're setting themselves up for failure, because in trying to rule over reality, they fail to understand it. And by misunderstanding it, they're really making themselves vulnerable or weak. In a sense, it's self-defeating. The will to power, or just the course that one takes, or the actions that one makes in trying to achieve power. What they're doing is actually they're missing something very important, which will be their downfall.
I think the clear example of that is when Saruman sends his army to fight Rohan in Helm's Deep, and ignores the fact that the Ents are on his doorstep. He certainly knows about the Ents, and he certainly knows what they're capable of, but he doesn't leave enough defenses to counteract the harm that he's done to the Ents. And I think that is definitely a sign of hubris, and is a sign of losing sight of reality in the pursuit of his goals.
Yeah, it's like you have a sort of singular vision to achieve this goal of power and possessing and imposing your will on others and controlling reality as you know it. But, you know, you sort of, it's almost like you're wearing some kind of like some blanket over your head, or some visor over your sight is so much more reduced when your vision is such that you're only focused on this sort of this one singular goal. And, you know, that's when your actions reflect wish fulfillment rather than, you know, making the correct decisions. Because Saruman makes a massive error in choosing to expand his power and dominion over Middle-earth rather than
as rapidly as he does.
Yeah. What he ends up doing is he makes himself weak and vulnerable because, you know, he's not... obviously, as we've said. I mean, he makes himself open to the attack of the Ents because he's just so determined to fulfill his wishes, to, you know, act upon his desire for power, for control, for greater power and greater control. And in doing such, he misses the one important detail that he should have considered. But he misses it because, you know, he doesn't care about playing it safe. He doesn't care about, you know, like, being content in his little world, his tower at Isengard. You know, no, he wants more. And it's like, all right, he makes that choice, and he's setting himself up for failure. I mean, it's... I don't know, if anything Lord of the Rings teaches, it's taught me that, like, you know, you're better off without power. It's just going to corrupt you, and, you know, you're setting yourself up for inevitable failure anyway. And, you know, it doesn't, you know, wandering around like Gandalf through Middle Earth and being friends with hobbits, doesn't that seem like a much more appealing life anyway than just, you know, ruling this dark tower where you don't see anybody and you don't see the world? I mean, there's so much wonder and joy in Middle Earth. There's so many exciting people, and it's like, you know, Saruman just kind of cuts himself off from all of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, that need for power kind of manifests itself in the scouring of the Shire. Because, you know, Saruman gets his... doesn't have his staff anymore, but he's still somewhat powerful. And he sets himself up as basically like a robber baron, maybe some sort of gangster, who's essentially in charge of the Shire. And he rules pretty much through gang tactics, as opposed to you know, with an army or anything. And he sets himself up in Bag End. I mean, that's a long way to fall. And rather than accepting defeat and moving on and changing your ways or something like that, he has to start gaining power all over again, even if it's over something as insignificant as the Shire.
Yeah, it's just kind of like he's been reduced to beggar status, but he's still... That's when you really see the delusions of grandeur really kick in. It's a shame that this bit was kind of cut out from the movies, but, you know, when you have a movie that drags on as long as Return of the King, it's understandable.
And it would be an anticlimactic ending.
It would, yeah.
Because it serves a literary purpose, but in a film, it doesn't serve that same purpose. It's supposed to show, like, the... you know, if you look at your hero cycle, Doug...
Brad.
You know, after the quest is complete, the ultimate boon has been achieved, and all the rest, the hero returns home and is now able to show and bring all of his new knowledge and strength back home to the inner world. And the Scouring of the Shire is showing that. Mm-hmm. That Frodo and Sam and Merry and Pippin have gone out there, gained all this experience, and now they know how to be warriors and heroes, and are able to be warriors and heroes in defense of their homeland, which is really what they wanted to be all along.
Yeah, well, totally. And I mean, it's a great scene between, I mean, yeah, to obviously showcase their, you know, acquired skills from their adventures abroad, but, you know, like, it also does a great job in showing, you know, Saruman, you know, just how, you know, like how much his delusions of grandeur have completely, like, taken him over. Like, he's, I mean, he goes from being like the head wizard,
and potentially ruling all of Middle Earth,
yeah,
conquering everything with a giant army of tens of thousands of Uruk-hai.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes from that to running a gang of hobbits.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, there you go. I mean, leader of his own little world.
Right, and everybody, there are a lot of people out there, I would say this in general, who like to be masters of their own little world, no matter how insignificant they are.
Mm-hmm.
But they rule it with an iron fist.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about Lucille Bluth being one of those when we were doing our Lucille Bluth cast. I mean, but...
And you'll find people like this in your career and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Who have their own little fiefdom, and they're willing to exercise full control over it and act like they're some sort of, you know, they enjoy having this power, even though it's so insignificant in the grand scheme of things.
If I may quote the monarch from Dr. Vet, not Dr. Venture, the Venture Bros.
Right.
He's in prison and he's doing a sort of like scared straight talk to everybody. And, I mean, it's kind of, I think it says more about the monarch than it does about these, like, kids. It's kind of like, oh, well, you know, you're one to talk. He says to the kids, you think you're hot shit in a champagne glass, but you're really cold diarrhea in a Dixie cup. And I think that Saruman, by the end of Lord of the Rings, has become cold diarrhea in a Dixie cup.
Wow, that's terrible, Doug.
But it also reminded me of what you were saying about, you know, the people, the leaders of their own little world. It's like, you think you're all that, and you just have no idea just how pathetic it looks. Like, do you see yourself? Right. Like, nobody cares.
Yeah.
It's...
Yeah. Power corrupts, but absolute power sounds kind of neat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
We were also kind of talking earlier in the podcast, or not the podcast, before the podcast, that Saruman is...
The pre-gaming party.
Yeah, exactly.
VIP members only.
Oh, indeed. yeah, we were talking about how Saruman rules over Isengard and how Tolkien kind of goes over, you know, all these other villains that just, in, you know, who want to seek power, characters who have, who want to control or whatnot. Like, they don't they have this one power base. This for Saruman, it's Isengard. For Morgoth or Melkor, it's Angband or Angband.
After Utmuno or whatever it's called.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's Angband for most of the Silmarillion.
Yeah, Island. And
after the first one gets sunk into the ocean.
Yeah. It's better off that way, but yeah, it's just I just think that it's worth talking about just how, you know, they have these power bases or they have this like one sort of center of control and they don't like to leave that. It's their eagle's nest, if you will, and they don't.
Sauron has Mordor,
mm-hmm.
And Dol Guldur, yeah, whatever, Dulgudur. He's got that, you know, he's got his power bases. Actually, the same thing goes for the Witch King, too, because he's got Minas Morgul.
Yeah. Not totally.
Yeah.
But it's...
Yeah, that's definitely the case. That his evil characters fear death is really the thing. Is that they truly fear dying. And rightfully so, because they don't have any sort of afterlife like men and elves do.
And they don't have power over death. Death is what has power over them.
Right. Exactly. And so you could think of that as that's what leads Sauron to create the ring in the first place, is because as long as the ring exists, he still exists. And the goal is that the power of the ring will keep it from being destroyed, because nobody will be willing to give up that power. And so, yeah, that it the ring is Sauron's way of cheating death. And also, I mean, Saruman goes down the same track of wanting to create a ring. The Balrog hides under the mountain, and Morgoth won't go outside. You know, he lives in a big underground cavern, and he never leaves, and he, you know, is only seen, like, twice over the course of thousands of years by anybody else.
Sounds like a lovely place to live, by the way. Just absolutely spectacular homestead.
What, Angband?
Oh, it just sounds lovely. You know, wouldn't you love to spend a holiday in Angband? Sublet that apartment in there.
Yeah, I think Kieran went on that vacation. And wasn't a big fan when he came out. He gave it one star on the app.
You know that William Shatner wouldn't be, promoting that for, what does he do, travel?
Priceline,
yeah.
Yeah, you don't think Shatner wouldn't be talking about the cheap rates at Angband Prison?
Yeah, the Priceline negotiator would be like, yeah, just, are you sure that's a good idea?
Yeah, with free, ruining your life in every way possible.
Only, one review by Huron.
Yeah, don't go here.
The only thing that it gave to me was sorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. You know, it's funny, as you were talking about just a lot of these bad guys or antagonists, like, they fear death and, you know, and they want power over it. Do you remember the reason why Emperor Palpatine was able to convince Anakin Skywalker to turn to the dark side in Revenge of the Sith was?
Right, so he'd be able to keep Padme alive.
Yeah, because he saw his mom die, and he didn't want that to happen to Padme, because he had a dream about it.
Yeah, and my dreams always come true.
Yep. Sometimes dreams do come true, Bradley.
Yeah.
But
no, that's a very good point, is that having the power over death is kind of the thing that maybe keeps the villain going, is that his quest for power over death. Certainly in Lord of the Rings, I would say that's the case, and it's the case with Anakin in terms of at least keeping other people alive.
But, you know, again, at what cost? You know, oh, you get to walk around in a, you know, a robot suit all day. Like, does...
And she dies anyway.
Is that any way to live? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And yeah, in Lord of the Rings, like, they talk, like, there's this one quote that, you know, kind of, I forget what it was, in what context, but he was, like, saying... It was almost a case in which Tolkien was, giving you a message, and he's just like, "Do you really want long life at the expense of your wits and, you know, to go mad and crazy, like, you know?" Yeah.
Well, look at Gollum.
Yeah, he had a natural long life.
Right, and it was the ring that kept him alive, and his obsession for the ring, and you see how that turned him to total crazy.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, there are not enough crazy pills in the world to make him sane.
Yeah, I forget who was it that said, a longer life is not necessarily a better life. Maybe it was Doctor Who, I don't know.
Yeah, Doctor Who lives forever anyway.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah, like, no, like...
Well, it's like what Arwen talks about that, too, in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Is because, you know, she says she'd rather have a mortal life where she gets to spend some of it with Aragorn than a life without, than an eternal life without him.
You know, it's funny, as much as Tolkien does a brilliant job in showing, you know, just the futility of seeking power, you know, he's got some brilliant love stories as well, like, I mean, Beren and Lúthien in the Silmarillion, like, whew! Like, that
almost brings a tear to your eye.
That's incredible. And
especially because Thingol is the father-in-law from hell.
Even Thingol and Malian's first story, it was, like, only a page and a half in the Silmarillion, like, that... Like, he talks about, like, Thingol finding Malian, like, this goddess, like, you know, in the forest by the water, and, like, the star shining down upon them, and just, it leaves you, like, on that note, and it's almost like you could literally see these two staring into each other's, eyes forever. Like, it's just, it's right. Unbelievable, and...
Thingol and Malian's daughter is Lúthien, which is why I was talking about him being a terrible father-in-law.
Yeah.
Because he's so over... Because, yeah. I mean, you have to read the story to really understand that, but...
And you should. It's a great. It's worth reading the Silmarillion. It's a rough read, but it's worth it.
I would not say Tom Bombadil and Goldberry is a great love story.
Wait, what's that story, Bradley?
I believe he goes to the river, finds her, and takes her home. I believe that's the extent of that love story.
Great love stories of mankind: Tom Bombadil and Goldberry.
Yeah, it might as well be the Romans and the Sabines.
Just, like, throw her over his shoulder and take
you
her...
You do know that story, right?
No, I don't, Bradley.
So, like, Rome was founded by a bunch of, like, cutthroats and outlaws, mm-hmm. and it was kind of a sausage fest. And...
Like Australia? I'm just kidding.
Well, similar idea. Or the lunar colony in the Moons of Harsh Mistress.
Totally.
There's, like, a similar thing, that it was founded by kind of the outcasts of society who didn't have anywhere else to go. Mm-hmm. So they were like, well, we need wives, and so they decided, and they just went over to a neighboring town, grabbed a bunch of women in the night, and brought them back to Rome and married them.
Huh.
And it started a short war before the Romans and the Sabines combined to become one people. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's called The Rape of the Sabine Women, and it's essentially a similar story to how Tom Bombadil gets Goldberry, as I recall. But Tom Bombadil's just such a silly story.
I mean, you just... This is definitely worth a podcast another time, but just so you come up to... he's not in the movies. Like, that's just the first most obvious thing about him, and just like...
It's like it would make the movies seem, like, less relevant.
Like, even Tolkien in interviews doesn't know how to talk about Tom Bombadil. It's like, even he's at a loss for words. It's like, you created it, man. Like, and you even don't know what to talk about it? It's like...
Well, because Tom Bombadil could put on the ring and nothing happened. Like, he was just like, yeah, whatever, nice ring you got there, Frodo.
No, it's like, you're in this, like, weird forest, and then you see this guy with a hat and a beard, like, singing and...
He's got a big feather.
Yeah.
His cap.
He sings about that.
He sings about that, yeah.
And just, it's just so, like, he just appears, and he disappears, and Tolkien's like, well, it does serve some kind of purpose, but it's to the overall, like, narrative, and I guess that is that, you know, even in this time of transitioning from less magical, you know, from more magical to less magical, you still have these, like, natural, like, these crazy mystical phenomena that you cannot explain. It's kind of just, like, inspiring awe and wonder in life and just how, you know, no matter... Some things you just cannot explain. And just Tom Bombadil's kind of there. But it's just... It's so bizarre. It's like... Every time I talk to somebody about Tom Bombadil, they're just kind of like, are you crazy? Like, am I crazy for talking to them about it? Like, you know, like, what are you talking about? And it's like, oh, yeah, he's just this weird guy with this beard and hat who just sings a lot of songs.
Dairy doll.
Yeah, he just... Yeah, he's always... Oh, yeah, that's another thing I love about him. He's always just like, we must hurry back home, hobbits, because Goldberry is waiting. It's like, well, we don't want to leave your lady waiting for you, Tom Bombadil. It's like...
Right.
It's like, oh, man, it's like, what... She must have some libido, Goldberry, because he's always talking about how she's waiting for him.
Yeah, let's see. I'm not going to look up to make sure. talk about Tom Bombadil's wife, Goldberry, the, quote, River Woman's daughter.
The River Woman's daughter.
Yeah, okay, Goldberry is just kind of crazy, too. But it seems like he pretty much just took her home one day. Like, that was just apparently all of it.
Yeah. And he, like, fights badgers, like you're telling me, and whatnot.
He doesn't fight badgers.
I'm sorry.
He goes into the badger's den and says, time to go to sleep. That's how he fights the badgers.
Oh, my goodness.
The Adventures of Tom Bombadil are just kind of a treat to read. But yeah, I guess we were talking about Saruman.
We were talking about Saruman.
Because that was a large digression there.
This may be our largest digression, like, ever.
Right, I mean, just because we like talking about Lord of the Rings so much, and there's so much good to talk about.
You know who else we like talking about? I didn't say his name, but yeah.
Someone who played Saruman in Star Wars, had an apprentice named...
Exactly.
Exactly. Alright, so, to Tom Bombadil... Not Tom Bombadil. Saruman. Get it together,
Freudian slip, maybe?
Freudian slip. No, I was looking on Wikipedia on Tom Bombadil.
As one does.
As one is wont to do from time to time. The, so we're looking at Saruman, we're looking at a character who has objectively looked at the battle between good and evil and say, I'm going with evil. He goes, I'm placing my bets here. If I, you know, he knows that he's a significant power, and he could sway, he can help to sway, sway the tide. So he goes, you know what, let's go evil here.
Tolkien might say he's making lies true through his actions. It's not necessarily that evil's going to win, but, you know, but he will make these lies so through his actions.
Yes, that is a cognitive bias, is what that is sometimes called.
Yeah.
Is that because you expect something, that you work for something to happen that you expect to happen, so then it's like a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
But essentially Saruman is working to, you know, Gandalf talks about how there's only one Lord of the Rings and he doesn't share power. And Saruman, I guess, knows this. You know, he's not an idiot. And he's really dedicated to taking power. And it's strange because he is joining with this huge monolithic bad guy who doesn't even have a physical form. He's this just ethereal bad guy. And he's joining forces with him in the hopes of eventually, you know, supplanting him and taking over. And I think it just makes it interesting for starters because, you know, I think it's always apparent in stories and this kind of thing that two groups of evil that are allied together, once they win, once they, you know, beat the good guys... they don't stay allied anymore. They almost never
do. It's like in World War II, almost. Like, I don't know, maybe I brought up an inappropriate, like, example. Like, I don't know, I was thinking the fact that, like, at one point Hitler and Stalin were allied, and that alliance didn't really work out.
Yeah, well, if you, you know, in Man in the High Castle, the way that ends is clearly trying to say the same thing. You remember that at all, Doug?
Oh, yeah, I love The Man in the High Castle. It's like a, you know, by Philip K. Dick, right. Great book. But the alliance between Japan and the Nazis and whatnot, how they're just kind of like, they have their own kind of thing, and they don't really have each other's self-interest in heart.
Right, and it eventually breaks down into nuclear war.
Yeah.
Is how it ends.
Feel-good novel of the year.
Yeah, real feel-good novel. Man in the High Castle is about the Axis powers winning World War II. And they were not able to stay allies in any sense of the word.
I mean, it's kind of like the U.S. and the USSR. Like, during World War II, we were allies, and then after that, we entered a Cold War with them.
Yeah. Yeah, and his patent said they should have kept rolling the tanks to Moscow.
Yeah, maybe it's better that didn't happen.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm trying to think of other examples from fiction where that happens. Where you've got two bad guys who ally with each other, and then once the threat is gone, once the good guys have been eliminated, it's hard because the good guys always win. But always, if you have allied bad guys, they tend to fight with each... there tends to be a lot of infighting.
Well, there's the Targaryens in Game of Thrones. I don't know if that's a good example. Like, everybody wanted them gone, and now that they're gone, it's like they're fighting each other now. Oh, but wait, there's another Targaryen who might enter the picture, so it's like,
Yeah. Or you have the Sith in Star Wars.
Yep.
Are like that they're always infighting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just has to do with kind of the nature of it all is that they can't, that because evil is looking for power and, sort of the way to cheat death in Lord of the Rings, that they can't ever ally with each other and stay allied. That they can't come to a mutually beneficial agreement, essentially. Because even the Soviet Union and the United States came to treaties and they formed the UN together, and they're able to be they were standoffish to each other, but it never broke down into all-out war, obviously. Everybody was able to tolerate each other's presence while trying to undermine each other, but it never was, all right, it's time for you to go. That never happened.
Yeah.
Yeah, so is there anything else you think we'd like to talk about Saruman? I mean, because he's, the turncoat, he's looking for power. I guess we didn't mention this explicitly, but he really is Gandalf's foil.
That's true.
In Lord of the Rings, because he stays in his castle while he stays in his wizard's tower, not talking to anybody, but while Gandalf, goes around hobnobbing with hobbits and elves and men and all the rest. And Gandalf is well-liked and appreciated, and so Gandalf's authority comes from that, whereas Saruman's authority comes from everybody acknowledging how powerful he is.
There's this, absolutely what you're saying, and, you said anything else about Saruman, and there's this great line that Gandalf says, "When did Saruman the Wise abandon reason for madness?" I think that's a great quote.
Yeah, and maybe he was listening to the Planter a bit too much.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think that just about wraps it up, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. No, I would agree with that statement. We did a...
You have some sweeping conclusion to make?
I'm at a loss for words, Bradley. Why don't you take over from here?
All right. So I think our sweeping conclusion on Saruman is that he's ultimately a character who is corrupted by his own lust for power and is corrupted by his... he's initially corrupted by wanting more power and to gain power over death. And he, as he goes down that path, it just gets worse and worse and worse until finally he's now become the evil that he started to fight. And that's ultimately how we look at Saruman, as a guy who has started from a place of goodness and progress to a state of total evil on the same level as Sauron, the ultimate evil in Lord of the Rings. I think that's kind of the best conclusion we can reach from all this. And I'd like to take a quick time to thanks everybody for listening. And if you like what you're hearing, enjoying it, share with anybody who you think would enjoy it. I mean, we enjoy having people listen. We like doing it. We like to have people listen. So if you've enjoyed it, share us on Facebook or however you want to do it. We don't, we're not too picky. But we would love to have as many people as, would enjoy it listening to it. That is really our goal. And, so if you think of anybody who would enjoy a single episode or all the episodes, be sure to recommend us. And thank you so much. And we'll talk to you later. Thank you.